Today's episode is brought to you by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, go to salesschema.com/takecharge.
I think if we take out some of the nomenclature, like Web3 versus Web2, what Web3 really just allows is the removal of the middle layer of the media platforms. So instead of you having to, as a brand, let's say you want to talk to your most engaged customers, typically that is either you have your email list, which is probably the closest thing to the direct to your community. But aside from that, it's a lot of paid acquisition. So you're feeding all of this cash into Google Display networks. You're feeding this into Facebook and Meta. You're feeding this into, you know, Twitter. Run down the list of all these different media channels. And what Web3 allows is the removal of that middle layer and going direct to your consumers and direct to the community itself. So I think that part of the learning curve is just understanding what that removal of the middle layer means for you as a marketer. But once you start to understand that, it gets you back to more of the principles of what marketing really was.
Welcome to the Digital Agency Growth Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Englander. Today's episode is brought to you by our company, Sales Schema. Are you tired of relying on unpredictable referrals to grow your agency or B2B service company? Yes, Dan, I am. So maybe you hired a salesperson or a lead generation company and your efforts failed miserably. So here's the problem. When it comes to selling agency services and other consultative offers, cold outreach doesn't work. And that's because there's so much competition and noise. And the scarce resource is not differentiators, at least not with the prospects who don't know you yet. So what's the scarce resource? It's actually trust. And at Sales Schema, we've worked with over 100 agencies and B2B service companies since 2014 to help generate qualified meetings and keep the pipeline full so our clients can achieve their dreams. And I've put everything we've learned into my book, Relationship Sales at Scale. And to learn more and pick up the book, you can do that by going to salesschema.com/RSAS. Again, that's salesschema.com/RSAS. Today on the show, I'm very excited to welcome Matthew Mizrahi. This was a fun interview about the state of Web3 after we had a little bit of breathing room to think about what it actually means in this day and age. And I think what you'll find interesting, even if you have no intention of going this direction, is what Myosin, the company that Matt is working with, is up to when it comes to DAOs and Web3 and all that good stuff. And I think it's a way to sort of broad frame the value exchange of an agency model and to think about it in a different way, again, even if you never go that direction. Beyond that, we really dug into the value of partnership models, and I think you'll come away with a few ideas in that direction. And as a small editorial note, I refer to a DAO as a digital autonomous organization, which is wrong. Not the first or the last time I'll be wrong on this show. It's actually what I meant to say was decentralized autonomous organization. So small note there. I think you're going to find this interview very interesting. Without further ado, please give it up for Matthew Mizrahi. Matt, great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Dan. Good to see you again.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a lot of interesting stuff for us to dig into. You're wearing definitely a number of hats. And Web3, I think, is like one of these things where I feel like there's a little bit of breathing room to have like perspective on it now. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not in the high point and we're maybe in a low point, but there's a little bit of space. And I think this is a really good time to have an interview like this. So getting ahead of myself a little for our audience, would you mind giving, you know, your background take as long or as short as you need to on that?
Yeah, of course. So I have been a career-long marketer and salesperson in one regard or another throughout the last decade or so. My background is a combination of working within agencies, everything from owner-operator to hands-on keyboard marketing support to consulting with agencies on operations and pretty much everything in between. The most recent company that I was at was Marketer Hire for about a four-year stint. There, I was part of the founding team. Helped the company grow from, you know, smaller product up to unicorn status in roughly that 4-year period. During that time, I worked on everything from the sales team to account management, and then ultimately getting back to my roots and building out our agency program, which was a combination of bespoke consulting as well as staffing for agencies. So that's where I worked with larger agencies such as WPP, Group M, Starcom, WPromote, sort of the whole gamut. So sort of getting back to the beginnings of my career, working with agencies in some capacity or another. So I always like to really focus my time and efforts on the junction of where sales, marketing, and account management meet, and work on how those three teams can work together in better synergy to increase revenue for the organization. So I think that there tends to be, in a lot of organizations, sales, marketing, and account management tend to be at odds with one another. But for the real unlocks of growth, it's always best to have those three working together in more harmony. So yeah, that's what brought us to chatting here today.
Awesome. Awesome. And can you go into kind of Myosin and how you got involved with them and from a high level, what you're up to there?
Yeah. So I've been at Myosin for probably around the last 6 months, give or take. I've been friends with the founding team for better half of the last 5 years. And so I met Simon again about 5 years ago at this point, who's one of the co-founders of Myosin DAO. And so they were at this really interesting place where momentum and sales were starting to scale up. So doing a little bit north of 1 million in the first year. And they realized that there was the opportunity to start operationalizing and providing structure to the way that they were pitching, account managing, and just overall operations for the business. So that's where they brought me in. And like I was mentioning a few seconds ago, I focus on the revenue ops. So how can sales, marketing, and accounts work together to help grow the business?
Cool. That makes sense. I definitely want to dig into that intersection because that's where things can get tricky. And there's lots of ways to think about a challenge like that. I guess, first off, can you explain, for those that don't know, what a DAO is and how one could apply that, like in an agency context?
It's a really unique model. And so again, like, I'm not a 50-year veteran of the marketing space, but I have studied a lot of the agencies over the years, and working within them for the last decade, I do have a lot of perspective. I haven't seen real innovation within the agency space throughout the entirety of my career. Maybe a little bit more transparency around how they leverage flexible staffing when you get up to the WPP scale, and there's the integration of all of these different boutique agencies to help support clients. But for the most part, I haven't really seen innovation within the marketing space until Myosin. So the reason Myosin is so effective is, again, leveraging that DAO model. So the way that I always explain this to potential clients, and just when I'm talking to folks about
this. Sorry to cut you off. For those who don't know, DAO is Digital Autonomous Organization. So I just thought I'd mention that. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So the model is really interesting, where when you engage with us on the front end, it feels like you're just working with a very top tier marketing team and agency. You get your account manager, you get your media buyers, you get your strategists, you get the community managers, everything that's required for the particular project at hand. But in the back end, the model of the DAO allows for true decentralization. So we have roughly 75 members across 25 different countries at this point. And what that allows us to do is be able to tag in individual team members into each one of these projects. So you're getting the best of the best marketing support. We have this all indexed and aggregated together. So we have the best of the best, both Web2 marketers as well as Web3 marketers. So you on the client side, you're getting the best of the best. We're able to keep a hand on cost, because that's the traditional problem with a lot of these agencies is if you're not verticalized into, again, like paid media or email marketing or email creative, it's really hard to be able to fill up a 40-hour work week for all of these individual niche roles, like a community manager, right? So for example, that's somebody who posts Twitter spaces, engages with the community and Discord channels. They're doing a lot of traditional Web2 community work as well. So like responding to the comments, engaging with accounts that you want to be in front of. But for a role like that within a traditional agency, the only way it makes sense is if you can fill 40 hours a week of work, or else it's going to be a cost center for the agency. So the DAO model allows us to be able to have people like those community managers at the wings. But since we're not paying them a salary and they're just a member of this co-op, we tag them in on each one of these individual projects. And that's the way that we can allow to offer a lot of different niche services within one group.
Awesome. And would you mind digging into that a little more? Like how are the incentive structures set up? And then how is that keeping people more engaged or around better than like a typical freelance model or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of pieces to that. I would say that at the forefront for me, it's how equitable the projects are scoped. So whenever a project comes in the door from Myosin, anywhere between 60 to 75% of the entire project value goes directly to the project team. All of this is completely on chain. You can trace from your first payment to the payout of each of the members within the project team. So there's that full transparency, both for clients, but also internally. So one, you're getting higher than market rates on every single one of the projects that comes through the door. Second, because of the way that we have aggregated knowledge, at the same time, we've really aggregated a lot of deal flow for the DAO as well. So we're getting access to top tier projects. Recently, we worked with Solana Mobile. We worked with Elastos, Filecoin, Aurora Network, a lot of the larger Web3 projects that marketers are really chomping at the bit to be able to work on. And the way that we incentivize them is through the application to the DAO. We're vetting for quality, we're vetting for fit within the community itself, and then also expertise. So that three-step vetting process really makes sure that whoever we're admitting into the DAO, top tier, they're in it for the long term, they understand the vision, and that allows us to be able to keep really top-tier talent engaged for long term.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if I understand right, you know, if I'm a brand and I'm hiring Myosin, 60, 70% of the project is going out to the people actually working on it. And then you can trace the individual people that are getting that revenue and so on.
And what that also really allows for is a lot of the team, myself, as well as a lot of the co-founders of Myosin, come from agency backgrounds. So we're really used to the traditional model of the larger agencies where it's really just the managing directors and VPs plus that are making all of the cash. And then the freelancers that are being brought on for individual projects are making $50 to $100 an hour. With this model, again, you're being rewarded for being best in class for each of the projects that you're being placed on. So it keeps everybody engaged and happy.
Yeah. And there's no markup potential, right? Because it's all transparent, right? So it's all
exactly
right there.
Yep. Yeah. And, so you see exactly what you paid into the retainer. You see where it goes within our treasury and then what gets paid out to the individual project team.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I guess with that, like, what are you finding on the brand side? Like, it seems attractive to a brand that they'd have that level of transparency. But at the end of the day, they're just thinking of, I want to get this problem solved. I want to get this project done and it's going to cost me X versus Y. How does that play out? Like, how does the bottom line from the brand perspective play out with this? So that question makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'd say that for the brands that we work with, what we really try and focus in on is just the outcomes. So, you know, whenever a brand comes to us, we spend a lot of time vetting them. Traditionally, I mean, it's nothing out of the norm for most agencies, but multiple rounds of calls with the clients, really refining and working with them collaboratively on the scope of work and the proposal, just to ensure that we're in step with one another. I always say to the clients as we're pitching them, again, with my agency background, if you are a brand with a problem and you go to a PR agency, they're going to solve that problem with PR. If you go to a paid search agency, they're going to solve that problem with paid search. The model of aggregating all of that talent across multiple disciplines allows us to look at the project scopes more objectively and build the right team in the back end. So if you are, you know, for example, launching a new dApp on the chain, we're not going to just take this one omni-channel approach. What we're going to do is take a look at what are all the different components that can help propel this and then build the team around it in the back end. So it allows us to really focus more so on the outcomes for the clients than getting really bogged down by, you know, like a specific KPI on a channel, because we can do the full agency of record.
As a quick break, I wanted to let you know about our newest video training, How to Take Charge of Your Agency's Future Revenue. By the end of this training, you're going to learn how we get 2 to 5 qualified appointments every week using tasteful and highly targeted email outreach. That might not sound like a lot, but once you understand the outreach napkin math, you're going to learn how this can lead to massive scale for your agency or B2B service company. In addition to that, you're going to learn the 6 steps for successful outreach campaigns based on everything that we've learned from working with more than 100 agencies since 2014. You're going to get the complete agency outreach tech stack so you understand the right tools for getting the right results. And you're going to see agency to brand email examples and get inspiration from high converting campaigns. So to get this 30-minute training, all you need to do is go to salesschema.com/take charge. Again, that's salesschema.com/take charge. Right. That makes a lot of sense. And how has it been in the last couple of years or however long you've been involved selling the AOR model? You know, I think that there's major pros and cons to it, right? Because it's like you have this big open-ended thing so you could solve the problem in any particular way. But it also makes it harder to brand yourself, right? Because it's more open-ended. So yeah, I'll leave that question.
Yeah. So I think that every brand, especially right now, is cost sensitive in one way or another. I think that that's an uphill battle with a lot of AOR services is it's pricey. I mean, you get what you pay for, obviously, but it is a large retainer that you're going to have on your budget sheet. That's obviously a hurdle, not just for us, but any agency that's pitching clients at this point in time. And so what it actually allows us to do with the back end of the DAO is, again, because not each of these members is on a salary and they're just tagged in on each one of these individual projects, it allows us to have all of the capabilities that, again, a WPP or a publicist has at their hands. And you're getting access to that whenever you compare it to those larger agencies at a much higher discount than you would find. Again, like a typical agency of record, WP or whatever is 500K a month, something around those tiers. If you're coming to us, you can get something below six figures and, you know, we'll take care of everything from messaging to content creation to media buying, PR, developer relations, pretty much everything A to Z for it. So, you know, where in some cases it might be limiting because if you're a traditional agency and you just have your internal employees and then maybe a few freelancers on the side, it can cause you to scramble to have to staff an account that's that large. But for us, it really feeds really nicely into the DAO model of being able to build the correct team for the client.
Got it. And just to understand that model a little bit better. So that 60 to 70%, that's just like going into a pot and then everybody that's part of the DAO gets a piece of it, or is it on a project by project basis, depending on who's working on it?
Yeah, so project by project basis, but I'll break that down a little bit more. So let's say, you know, you're coming to us for a minimal engagement. So let's call it 10K a month. Of that 10K a month, let's say you have your account manager and strategist and let's say a community manager. So those three members that are working on your project, they'll receive 60% of that directly. So 6K of that per month is getting distributed to those three different members. And that's on a very equitable split. Then what we take from the remaining is 10% of it goes to whoever brings the deal to the table. So whether or not that's inbound, that just gets rolled up into our treasury. And I'll explain what the treasury is in a second. But 10% of that, if it's inbound, goes back into the treasury. If it's a referral, we pay that out as a referral fee to either business development person who brings it to the table, or if it's an outside agency or person, they get paid that 10% as well. And then that leftover, typically like 25-35%, that goes into our treasury. So what a treasury is basically within the DAO, so you know, decentralized autonomous organization, the DAO itself is able to vote on how the funds are leveraged. So again, when the project comes in the door, percentage of that goes into the treasury, which is just think of that as like a open ledger business account that everyone has, you know, view into. People have a say in how that gets allocated and how we spend it. Typically, what we do with that is we do a lot of in-person events and activations. We're also using a lot of those funds to build out a product studio in the back end. So we're launching a lot of upcoming Web3 MarTech tools and SaaS. And so it really allows us to be able to take a lot of control over the funds and operate the business in a way that isn't only just best for, you know, the core team and the founders, but also the direction that the DAO wants to see the products and the agency head.
Got it. That makes sense. And then for the roles that aren't directly associated with the engagement, like servicing the engagement, I should say, like if you have like a dedicated sales role or admin or whatever, are those people paid out through the treasury, or how does that typically work?
Yeah, so it depends. So it's a combination of both what's paid out via the treasury and then also just what's hunted. So, I mean, if you're a business development or a salesperson, we don't have any full-time employees other than myself and one other person plus the co-founders. And so, yeah, there's no salaries, no costs that we have sunk on a monthly or annual basis. Business development folks, they just get a percentage of the deals that they bring to the table. And then you as a member of the DAO get cash through the projects that you work on. We also have, so this is getting into some more of the details of the DAO. So we also have our own governance token. So what a governance token is you can basically think of it as just like there's all these other, you know, tokens and coins that are out there, but it's very specific just to our DAO. What it does is it gives you ability to vote on where treasury funds go, things like where our next in-person events and activations going to be. And then there's a lot of other cool smaller things that get to be leveraged through those tokens. So we also comp a lot of the contributors through that governance token. So it's a great way for us to be able to reward people who are contributing, you know, for no cash, and then also give them some more power and autonomy of how we run the DAO.
Got it. That makes sense. And to go to, you know, to the employee or the ops side a little bit, like, what's a day in the life like for somebody that's active on a project in the DAO versus if they just were on, you know, typical part-time freelance model? Like, how does that, the lifestyle compare? Like, how does the quality of the work compare? Because it sounds like it's part-time with both of those models, but I'd love to understand kind of the day-to-day differences there.
Yeah, do you mean for like myself and the operator? You mean more of the marketers who are
more people like actually active on the project and that sort of thing? Yeah.
So I think, I mean, honestly, just getting into it, a lot of marketers that have entered and are still continuing to enter Web3, the reason that they have such a high amount of excitement is it's a really innovative space where you're able to take risks. You're able to do interesting work for your clients. You're able to go out on a limb and try something that maybe hasn't been tried before. And it's not just this predetermined cookie cutter approach that I think a lot of marketing has become, where it's, you know, you run these five different channels, you look at these five different KPIs on each of the channels, you scale and allocate budget accordingly across them, rinse and repeat for each of your clients. It's a pretty fleshed out model at this point for a lot of Web2 companies. So the reason a lot of really smart marketers are still interested in Web3 is because you can do unique and interesting work for a lot of your clients. So one, that's really interesting because of the other Web3 agencies within the space. They've gotten to the size where, you know, there's a lot of risk. They're behind a large holding company where, you know, if they do something that's a little bit out there, like that can blow back on the parent company. And obviously that causes a lot of red tape. So we remove a lot of that. And then I'd say that just the amount of, you know, money that they're able to make from our platform is so much higher than any of these other freelance models out there. And they see it. So they know that they're making a certain percentage of that project when it's being scoped, whenever the payments are going out. So it feels like they're really getting an equitable piece of the pie, which is really interesting. So, and then that allows them to be able to work on a lot of other things. So it's really, really amazing to see within the DAO, a lot of these members, their second and third jobs are not just more freelance marketing. They're creative. Some of these people are writers, DJs, artists, people who have their own podcasts, have their own newsletters. So it really, really attracts creatives, but also people who are just interested in doing cool stuff.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that was going to be my question, is kind of like, because with any part-time or freelance model, you always have that skin in the game problem, right? Where you have somebody and they're really good, but then you got to bring them on full-time to keep them or they'll migrate. So it sounds like the way that you're dealing with that is just a bigger pot of the money, you know, and sort of more ownership over the process and everything. So,
yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, just a small example, and, you know, these aren't exact numbers or anything, but let's say just a typical community manager. So, you know, you can equate that to just a social media manager within Web2 marketing. Those people are probably making, even if they're the best of the best on the most part, under $100 an hour. So you figure their upside is capped. They have a potential ceiling that they're going to hit pretty quickly. But for the DAO, I mean, we have projects that have come through the door for, again, something very similar. And these people are making, you know, like $8K a month working 20 to 40 hours over the course of the full month. So they're really able to take home a larger piece of the pie. We really practice what we preach, and that we want everybody in the DAO to win. For us, it's not about just cashing this out in, you know, a year or two. It's really about building up each of the members within the DAO and taking them with us as we scale this.
Yeah. And how is this model progressing? Like, is it going, like, how far is it going outside the Web3 world? Are you bringing on older school freelancers or people that maybe haven't set up a wallet before? And if so, like, how does that educational process play out?
Yeah. It's definitely a combination. I would say that certain industries don't necessarily need to be bogged down by the nuance of Web3, like brand marketing, for example. You can still be a really great brand marketer, even if you haven't worked within Web3 yet. You can still be a really great creative director, even if you haven't done creative directing for a Web3 project. So we try and look at overall skill set, but obviously there is a steep learning curve to Web3. I think if we take out some of the nomenclature, like Web3 versus Web2, what Web3 really just allows is the removal of the middle layer of the media platforms. So instead of you having to, as a brand, let's say you want to talk to your most engaged customers, typically that is either you have your email list, which is probably the closest thing to the direct to your community. But aside from that, it's a lot of paid acquisition. So you're feeding all of this cash into Google Display networks. You're feeding this into Facebook and Meta. You're feeding this into, you know, Twitter, run down the list of all these different media channels. And what Web3 allows is the removal of that middle layer and going direct to your consumers and direct to the community itself. So I think that part of the learning curve is just understanding what that removal of the middle layer means for you as a marketer. But once you start to understand that, it gets you back to more of the principles of what marketing really was. You know, marketing is really just the pairing of demand and attention with products. And I think that a lot of these platforms like Meta and Twitter and Google over the years have really turned marketers into just data analysts, where they're just pulling spreadsheets on a daily basis, watching pacing reports, looking at a few different KPIs and just toggling budgets accordingly. That's not everyone. Obviously, there's a lot of creatives out there and there's a lot of nuance to it. But
yeah,
this shift is really making it so that marketers can get back to marketing, right? Like understanding how to pair attention and demand with products and in a way that makes sense for everyone.
Yeah. And that really resonates with me, because like what Bo and I always have to pick is just kind of like how much sort of like Stockholm syndrome there is with paid media, where it's almost like, it's almost sort of presented to marketers a lot of the time is like, if in order to ethically market to people, you have to pay a Silicon Valley tech company this money for the privilege of doing that. And I'm not saying that's bad or not to do it, or that there is an opportunity there, but it's like, that's presented as like the only option, right? And my perspective is more with email and with outreach done tastefully and then the right way to get meetings. And it sounds like Web3 is a new version of that. It's just a sort of a weak protocol with strong apps built on top of it. It's a strong protocol with many apps built on top of it. So
yeah,
it makes a lot of sense.
Totally. And, you know, we dubbed this phrase internally. So, you know, early 2000s, a lot of brands were realizing that they didn't have to go through wholesale. They didn't have to go through, you know, these large 3PLs. They could just go direct to community. So that was what spawned all of this innovation within the CPG and D2C space over the last 10, 15 years. And you saw all these brands that sprung up from this new model of removing that middleman between them. So we have our version of that we just call direct to community, which is the exact same thing. You're removing that middle layer of those Silicon Valley social media platforms. You're taking out that middle layer and just going direct to your community in this case versus the consumer. So it really allows for more authentic relationships with your consumers, but also, like you touched on it briefly there, just like more ethical ways as well. Because, I mean, say what you will about the platforms, like they're big, big cash cows, and some people just don't feel like feeding into that in the long term.
Yeah, and I sort of feel like every sort of marketing requires interruption on some level, right? Even like Godin, who I love to death, we'll talk about permission marketing, but to get permission, what do you have to do? You have to interrupt someone. So the question is, what's more ethical, a transparent system that everyone can see and everyone at all levels, or one where you're signing a TOS that you can never possibly read, that's, you know, allowing somebody to follow you around and listen to you on your phone and all these other things. So that all makes sense. I guess to close out the Web3 stuff and then hopefully move on to other things, like I said at the beginning, we hopefully have a little more perspective than we did, or whatever, a year or two ago on this. Like,
where do you think the fluff is or was versus what are you excited about? Like, what do you see as the tangible business or real world applications of like Web3 over the next few years?
I have a few thoughts on that. The first one is, I think that a lot of the nomenclature and the classification of Web2 versus Web3, although necessary in a lot of ways, sort of hinders mass adoption in a lot of other ways. The way that I always describe this is, again, like early 2000s, there wasn't this big push of this is Web2 or this is Web 2.5. Is all of a sudden, your ad experiences got more tailored to you. Websites that you were popping up on knew a little bit more about you and what type of products you'd like to see, what types of things that you will interact with, just user preferences, and start following you around the internet. No one made a big fuss about this being Web2 and this all new technology. It just happened. I think that Web3 is going to start picking up momentum in that same way, where user experiences on just certain brands and certain websites are going to feel a little bit more tailored. All of a sudden, you're going to have a little bit more ownership over your data. I mean, take the iPhone, for example, of being able to shut off tracking across different websites. These are small steps in that direction of consumers owning their data a lot of the basics of Web3 being adopted. So I think that for it to really start happening, consumers are just going to begin interacting with Web3 technology without noticing it. So interacting with smart contracts, interacting with different loyalty programs. Take Starbucks Odyssey program, for example, where there's a lot of people out there that are collecting these NFTs from Starbucks without really understanding the underlying tech. They just know Starbucks. They trust Starbucks. It's a brand that they already interact with on a daily basis, but it's just another way to reward their loyalty. And I think that that's the way that we're going to start seeing this pick up steam in a lot of different ways. You know, I would say that also I've particularly been excited and interested in Web3 during this down market within crypto. I think that whenever the hype cycles die down, the real builders and people who see the underlying technology stay and focus on building things. We saw a big boom and bust over the last couple of years of projects that had no business being projects, to be honest, happening and raising large amounts of cash, all of it just to be wiped off of the table. I think that people learn their lessons in a lot of ways around, if this doesn't make sense, you know, as a standalone business, why would it make sense if it's a Web3 version of that business? I like to say, like, if you take the word Web3, and this is even applicable now to the big AI craze, if you take the word Web3 or crypto or AI out of the sentence, are you still solving a problem that needs to be solved? And if the answer is no, and on top of that, you don't have real economics behind the product, it doesn't really have a place in the market. So I think that we just saw the natural dying off of a lot of these fluff projects and things that were just in here for cash grabs. And now the real innovation is happening within a lot of these different protocols, different layers that are being built. So it's going to be really exciting to see how this all pans out over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I love that framing. If you take Web3 AI, et cetera, out of the sentence, is there anything left there? And this reminds me of this Eric Weinstein quote, where it's basically like people look for their blind spots so they can do business there, right? Where it's like, it's not just that people get fooled. It's like we actively look for the things we don't understand so we can throw money at those things with the hope of something changing.
Yeah. Right? You're exactly right about that. And obviously, like, I don't applaud that a lot of these projects went under, because I think a lot of people are just caught up in the hype cycles, really smart people and people who bet a lot on, again, like, different coins or different projects working out. But I think that that was the only way that we could progress as an industry, is to cut out a lot of these redundant or non-value producing projects.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And to shift gears a little bit, you also have an active consulting practice where you're working with agencies, other B2B companies, and focusing on many things, but among them, setting up partnerships and finding the right partners and so on. I think the most common like partnership work that we've engaged in, but we also see a lot of clients engaging in, are these sort of like networking calls where you're like, hey, do you know anyone? Here's our contract. We give this referral fee. And then you have like dozens of those throughout a year, and very few, if any, pan out to anything, because everyone's busy. Everyone's focused on their own day-to-day stuff. And then finding opportunities for others to get a referral fee is not always that attractive. So if that's kind of the model that's less successful, like what are you finding to work? What's a more profitable way of thinking of these partnerships?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say that the experience that you were describing is the same one that the majority of marketing companies and just honestly B2B companies experience in general, which is you get on the call with a partner, everyone is hyped up, everyone is like, yeah, I'll send you deals. Yeah, you send me deals. I can't wait. We're going to scale this. It's going to be amazing. And then a week goes by, a month goes by, nobody has touched base again, no deals are flowing. Or if they are, typically what I'll see is it's a one-way street. So one partner is really invested in making this relationship happen. They're passing on opportunities, they're passing on leads to that agency or partner, but it only goes one way. Because like you just said, you need somebody who is keeping an eye on the partnerships, auditing them and measuring it just as you would any other marketing channel. So I think a good way of looking at it is if you were breaking down how your leads and how your revenue is attributed, you should be looking at, again, like, this is what has come from my webinars. This is what has come from podcasts. This is what's come from direct outbound. This is what's come from our social channels. This is what comes from our partners. And then breaking that down just as you would a meta channel where it's like, here's the five different partners that I have. Here's the different things that they're really good at. Let's actually track back and see what's been coming from each of them, how those deals have matured, what's the quality look like, what's the revenue for each one of these partners. And getting granular in how you evaluate your partners is really important because I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. You can't grow what you can't measure. So if you don't have a system in place of measuring your partnerships, evaluating success behind them, you're always going to be in this cycle of just adding new and new partners, but never really building strong bonds. So what I really try and focus in on is taking the same approach that I've learned from Myosin and Marketer Hire and a lot of these freelance platforms of extensively vetting the partners that you want to bring on board. So understanding who are they? What are they the best at? Even talking to some of their clients and understanding, hey, they're really amazing at account management, but maybe they might not be the best at copywriting, and understanding where those blind spots are within them as well, so that you can understand how to leverage them within your agency. And always finding complementary products, I think, is a big piece of this. I tend to see a lot of, for example, like a paid media agency. They want to go and form a partnership with a WPromote or a Tinuity, where it's like, that agency is basically full service. They're across every single different discipline. You're going to be a really small fish coming for them. So you're typically not going to be prioritized with any deals that they're going to pass on. And that makes it tricky as well. So I try and find agencies that are within the same bands for services, the same scale as you as well, and have the same long-term goals as you do. So that way both parties can contribute to each other's growth intrinsically and grow together. So I think that's the way I tend to look at a lot of these partnerships.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that. And I also think that sometimes you have to flip it. Like, everybody starts from who's like encountering our clients and who can send us referrals, as opposed to what do our clients need and who can we send referrals to. And that's not just a hand wavy, being a nice person thing. It's also just like, that's where you actually have leverage, because then you can go and say, hey, I have these people that have this need. Can this be a two-way street, and test it and everything from there?
Exactly. Yeah. It's using those opportunities that either you would pass on as an agency or wouldn't even think to offer to your clients as bargaining chips, basically, for increasing deal flow for your agency. So like you just described it, that's a perfect example. I'm working with an SEO agency as a perfect example of this, where they've end at a lot of the SEO practices. And so a lot of their clients will typically ask them for content production. So can you help me out with these five different types of content and then distribute it across channels? Typically, they would just say, no, sorry. Maybe if the salesperson that day thought to mention different platform or a different agency, then maybe they make the referral. But a more strategic way of going about it is sitting down with the founders and the heads of sales and account management, really helping educate them on what those upsell opportunities look like. And then once they sell them, the fulfillment end of it typically goes on that partner agency. So it's a really great way of both for you as an agency, what you're solving is you're increasing revenue for each of those accounts. You're monetizing more opportunities that you would typically pass on. And then while you're doing this, you're also building a partnership that will lead to increased deal flow for your agency. So it's really this great way of solving 3 to 4 different problems, all of it tying back to revenue, but with just a little bit of strategic thinking.
Right. And you're also not having to build out that capability, which is usually much harder to do than it seems, right? So that makes a lot of sense. I think with that, are there any kind of like underappreciated partnership angles for agencies that the most aren't always seeing at first?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, again, like a lot of the agency to agency pairing is interesting to me. I've seen it work with overwhelming success. I'd say, you know, another one that sometimes gets overlooked is service providers and different SaaS companies that they could partner with. So let's say you are, you know, like a paid media agency, forming relationships with somebody like a Triple Whale, which does the analytics for paid acquisition, is a great way of getting in front of the same audience. The way that I would encourage brands and agencies to think about it is remove either agency or the word B2B and just look at, is their audience similar or the same as what our target audience is? So if you want to go after B2C brands or e-commerce companies that do beauty, right? Like look at what products and what services and what tools they're already using and figure out how you can partner with those providers to get in front of their audience. I think that that's a really good way of looking at it. The actual channel and approach is going to vary a lot, but as long as there's that crossover in who you're trying to sell to and get in front of, it's a worthwhile partnership to consider.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And from there, you can really broad frame it. You know, it could be NGOs, it could be awards organizations, it could be event sponsors, it could be tech, it could be other service providers and that kind of thing. And I like the idea of looking at organizations that are comparable to you in terms of size, because your priorities and your skin in the game is going to be the same as opposed to if you go after the big behemoth, right? That's doing a million things and so on. So that makes a lot of sense. Matt, this has been so much fun. I think we've covered a lot of ground. Where can people go to learn more about what you're up to and get in touch and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so I'm primarily active on LinkedIn at this point. So that's my main channel. So definitely reach out there. Aside from it, you can find me at moz.co. So that's moz.co. And then for Myosin, that is myosin.xyz. So those are the three places you can find me from here.
Awesome. We'll get those linked up and let's do it again. Thank you, sir.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Again, today's episode is sponsored by our company, Sales Schema. Sales Schema helps agencies and B2B service companies build a reliable business development system through tasteful and targeted outreach. To learn more about us and check out our latest video training, again, you can go to salesschema.com/take charge. Again, that's salesschema.com/take charge.